Paul, you have a new article out for American Greatness, if I'm not mistaken, and it is about the conflict between Black Lives Matter and the pro-vaccine forces who want, obviously, the Black community to get vaccinated, specifically in New York City. And the article may not have been published as of yet, but it's supposed to be coming out later tonight. So please explain the article and why you think it's relevant for people.
Well, the article, I think, won't be out until about 12 o'clock tonight. It'll be out tomorrow, certainly. I seem to be obtaining new details about this every day. But there is a widening conflict between Blacks in New York, most of whom refuse to get the vaccinations. At most, the ones who do have it seem to have one vaccine. And they do not have vaccine passports, which are necessary to get into restaurants and places of commerce. And they're being kept out. Mm-hmm. And they insist that this is segregation and racism. Mm-hmm. And the head of Black Lives Matter in New York, somebody named Hawk Newsom, is threatening the city with massive demonstrations of the kind that was seen last year after the death of George Floyd. And the national head of BLM has made exactly the same threat. Mm-hmm. And what I do is I sort of speculate on what are the possible options for the Democratic Party going forward. One of them, you know, I suggest is simply trying to change the conversation, mm-hmm. which people like Arian Pressley,
Ayanna Pressley, mm-hmm.
right, the representative of Cambridge Somerville, that is of Harvard and the surrounding area, you know, has been putting forth that our major problem is white racism. And it is important that we all unite against systemic racism, which absolutely pervades, you know, white America. And this most recent manifestation is the attempt to hold back Haitians from having free access to the United States or open access. And the efforts of these slaveholders on horseback, you know, to whip Haitians who are asserting their right to live in the United States in order to break the hold, I suppose, of systemic racism. The Reverend Al, Maxine Waters, others, you know, take this position. So by diverting attention from New York to the southern border in Texas, right, and talking about systemic racism, as did Secretary Mayorkas yesterday, that this is the newest evidence of systemic racism, what these people on horseback did. Although he also, after telling us this, he said it was going to be an open investigation. So this will, you know, is useful in terms of segueing into a new conversation about America's sins of racism. I look at a number of options that seem open to the Democratic Party to sort of cool things down in New York. But then I finally come to the conclusion that if things get any worse, the Democratic Party will simply allow Blacks to enter restaurants without vaccines on the grounds that they have been victims of racism, and systemic racism still permeates our country. And therefore, it is necessary to make special provisions for Blacks who may be, you know, hesitant about getting the vaccine. But we have to sort of give them a wide berth because of the way we persecuted them. And really because of their value to the Democratic Party. And we'll just, you know, let them enter restaurants without vaccine certification. Mm-hmm.
Do you suppose that this will go over well with the Democratic base outside of the Black community, which is rather fanatical about COVID, to say the least?
Well, I think they will make an exception. I quote Rochelle Walensky, who said that a major public health issue in the United States is systemic white racism. So, you know, she's sort of caught on the horns of a dilemma, isn't she? You know, on the one hand, she wants to have everybody wear masks and get all these vaccines and boosters and extra boosters and so forth. On the other hand, you know, she's a liberal Democrat who wants to play to the black base.
And do you suppose that the Democratic Party, if they went through with this, do you think that it would make them more or less popular, I suppose, at election time?
I don't think it would have that much of an effect. I think it would help consolidate or reconsolidate their black base, which they don't seem to be in any danger of losing. I mean, I'm sure Black Lives Matter will not switch its loyalties to Senator Cruz or Rand Paul, right? This ain't going to happen. So, there are no danger of losing Democrats, you know, and most of the whites who put up with all their shenanigans until now, including critical race theory, beating up on the white race, having, you know, open borders to fill the country with future Democratic voters, people who can stand all of this will put up with, you know, making exceptions for blacks who want to enter restaurants in New York City and elsewhere without vaccine certification.
It's interesting because obviously the Democrats' position would be quite weakened by doing this on an intellectual basis, but it would presume that they really care about intellectual consistency in the first place, which I definitely don't think is the case.
I agree with you. I mean, I don't think, I mean, the notion that somehow the party of intellectuals is ridiculous, you know, they're the party of haters. They're people who hate ordinary white people and, you know, have declared war on them. They seem to be at war with all normal social relations at this point, against the traditional family, against the nation state, against, you know, communities that have not been taken over by social workers or, the forces of the deep state. So, you know, I don't think there are, you know, they're a party of intellectuals only if we identify intellectuals with a certain transformational vision of the world, and above all with relentless hostility toward what I call normal white people.
Yet, obviously, the hate whitey, if you will, contingency is something which the Democratic Party has profited off of immensely in recent years, and there's no indication that this is going to end anytime soon. Do you suppose, though, that there will be some of the Democratic base, which is mostly this part of it is mostly white, that's really nervous about COVID, that just goes so bonkers over some sort of exemption being made for the black community that it causes some sort of conflict within the Democratic ranks that at least stymies the Democrats' public relations effort headed into 2022?
No, I don't think it will at all. I mean, after seeing what happened last summer, you know, where you have Black Lives Matter being funded by Democrats and having vandals, BLM and Antifa vandals being released from jail after they're vouched for by Democratic operatives like Kamala Harris. And the party nonetheless, you know, winning something like 75 million votes or whatever they really won, I can't be sure, but we'll assume it's like 75 to 80 million votes. People just don't care. I think the country is polarized in such a way that those who have stayed in the Democratic Party this is about Democratic moderates. I don't buy at all. These are not Scoop Jackson Democrats. They're not Truman Democrats we're dealing with. They're cultural social radicals who have it in for white people. And they also have it in for minorities who side with normal white people.
Absolutely.
So, they've put up with all this crap so far. I mean, you know, so simply saying we'll let blacks go, you know, enter restaurants and stores in New York and other cities without vaccine certification, is not more than these people would be able to stand. I mean, after I watched them at Democrats last summer justifying those riots, the shooting of police, the burning down of public buildings, and saying it either didn't happen or if it happened, the people they went after deserved it, I knew that there was absolutely nothing that the Democrats will not put up with in order to have their party in power.
It is interesting how one might say obsessed they are with keeping their party in power. Some the Democrats say the Republicans are so obsessed with keeping their party in power that they try to suppress the vote, blah, blah, blah. But in your estimation, the Democrats are much more disciplined about keeping themselves in power than the GOP is, correct?
Yeah, no, I'd say they're much more determined. Mm-hmm. And they know they have the media, high tech, corporate executives on their side. The educational establishment, so they're much more confident about what they're doing, mm-hmm. you know, because they have a much larger base of support. Mm-hmm. But the I think they, to some extent, they also believe more deeply in what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not entering politics as an alternative to being a funeral director or an insurance agent or something. You know, to them, there is a total commitment. This fellow running in Ohio, what's his name? Vance?
I don't remember. J.D. Vance.
J.D., right. You know, America, that, you know, people like us have kids and families. Mm-hmm. All these people do is, you know, have careers and seek power. And so I think it's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I also find that Republicans are more easily intimidated. Mm-hmm. Democrats are absolutely brazen. And I say this to their credit. You know, I wish the Republicans acted this way more often. There is one Republican representative from Indiana named Banks, mm-hmm. whom I really admire because he sounds like a Democrat, but he's on the other side. You know, he really goes after the other party with passion, mm-hmm. you know, and he also has much better organized arguments. He probably, you know, has an intelligence level 2 standard deviations higher than that of Adam Schiff. but you know, I wish we had more leaders like Representative Banks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously the Republicans are in a position where they do not have demographics on their side nationally, and the idea of a captivating leader matters less and less because swing voting is not as much of a thing as it used to be. So I suppose for them to have high-powered intellectuals on their side is something of the best-case scenario.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I don't know if the Republicans necessarily are in a worse position than the Democrats. Well, the Democrats, once they flood the country with all these illegals and give them voting rights, will, you know, have a perpetual majority. I mean, this is what it's about. And they have to do this before the midterm elections, certainly before the next presidential election. That's obviously their game plan, even if Mitch McConnell doesn't want to see it. But the Republicans, you know, are not in a bad position in some ways. The more and more of the Hispanic vote outside of California is going to vote for them, particularly Mexican Americans, Central Americans. They might not be doing, and if Puerto Ricans in Florida, who are usually sort of the professional classes coming over, are now voting Republican. So, I mean, they do have that base. The Asian, that they're at least those from the Far East Asians are voting for Republicans in a larger number. And I think I said in a conversation earlier today, I think that college students who are not in elite universities where they're having their brains laundered seem to be becoming disillusioned with the Democrats. You know, I was saying the college where I work, is not exactly a hot spot of support for Kamala Harris and Mayork and so forth. And I wouldn't be surprised if half the students voted Republican in the next election. I don't think we should confuse elite universities, you know, or those that have sort of long-time liberal reputations with ordinary colleges. And I think that the Republicans are not going to do badly, you know, and certainly they're going to do well among those who don't go to college. Uh-huh. And they will do well among evangelicals, obviously. Mm-hmm. I doubt they're going to do any worse in terms of the Jewish vote, probably the same. The black vote, they're not going to get anyhow. So there's no reason to even talk about them. You know, my view on this, I think the pursuit of the black vote is absolutely idiotic on the part of the Republicans. It's okay to try to get black votes, but don't, you know, drag yourself through the mud almost ritualistically day and night, you know, busy, they were going to vote for us and you know, we love Martin Luther King and we hate these Confederate statues. It goes on and on like this. And I don't think blacks give a damn about it. I mean, the only thing is these people are amusing each other or pleasing each other by who can be more politically correct. I think they should just cut this stuff out entirely, you know, and turn their energies elsewhere, perhaps to winning, as I say, more white Catholic votes. You know, there are many of them, you know, in these places like New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. Maybe the Republicans can win more of those. And I think there's, you know, there's a lot of Hispanic votes that they can pick up. Hispanic voters seem to be turning toward the Republicans.
And I will just say before we get to some stuff left from Paul and myself, that I think that when it comes to pursuing the white vote, there really isn't much of a Catholic vote that's devout, that's not already voting Republican or Democratic on the basis of social justice politics. I think what the GOP has to do is try to attract more blue-collar whites who are politically alienated and who feel that neither party is looking out for them. But it can't be ridiculous in doing this either and, like, you know, doing some over-the-top appeal to them, which is sort of, you know, patronizing. It has to really look at their issues and find ways of dealing with them in the context of what's politically possible.
Yeah, I agree with you, by the way. I think I misspoke. I think what I really meant was blue collar. And, you know, I think of blue collar workers, at least where I grew up in Connecticut, as being all Catholic. But obviously they're not anymore. But, you know, I think there's a blue collar vote which still can be won over, and particularly by Republicans running as populists. And I know in the area in which I live, they're mostly blue collar Protestants, you know, and I think they are voting now in greater number for the Republicans. They're not switching parties so much as just voting. Yes. And they didn't vote before. And I think Trump did a great service by bringing some of these people into the political process.
Absolutely. Well, I agree 110%. And now to get to some stuff left for us, this was from an especially generous donation to the show. But the person who asked this did request to be left anonymous, so I shall honor that. But the question is, inspired by a documentary about the Vietnam War and how it relates to the Afghanistan disaster, what is your opinion regarding Nixon's handling of the withdrawal and public response to it? I was born over a decade after the fall of Saigon, so I have no lived experience of this era. He seemed to have been handed a bad hand that forced him to walk a tight rope, extricate troops in an active war, negotiate prisoner release, deal with anti-war protests, control native leftist agitators, etc., all while propping up the South Vietnamese government and trying to win re-election. With that said, nearly 20,000 troops died from 1969 to 1973, which could have been mostly avoided if we would have just left Vietnam as quickly as possible. Do you believe our slow withdrawal was due to the unwillingness of North Vietnam to negotiate, the political maneuvering of Nixon, or both? There's more here, but I have to get to the two core questions here, and I will repeat them. Let's see here. What is your opinion regarding Nixon's handling of the withdrawal and public response to it? And we'll get to the next one after that. But Nixon, sorry, Paul, as someone who knew Nixon, anything to say about that for us?
Well, I should say that I was a junior professor by the time that war ended. Mm-hmm. I think comparisons between then and now don't work very well. The Vietnam War, the crisis of the Vietnam War was much greater than anything we're seeing right now. And I think for one of the reasons this gentleman gave, well, I mean, they lost 50-something thousand people in that war, right? Well, what did they lose this year? Maybe 2,000 people over a 20-year period. And, you know, not all of them necessarily were, I don't know if they were all war casualties. They might have died for other reasons. But, you know, that's sort of the death toll that we have. I mean, so the other one was like 25 times or more greater. The whole country was split over that war, right? They were drafting people to fight. You had an anti-war movement. And much of the anti-war movement although I don't think was directly controlled by communists, was pro-communist. I mean, they supported the communist side. Very few people in the United States, I think, supported the Taliban, you know, in Afghanistan. I mean, the political division in America today is at least as great as anything I've ever seen. But I don't think the war in Afghanistan has much to do with it, because it was largely, you know, war that went on in the background, you know, and it took for years there was nobody dying in the war. So, you know, it just happened to be a war that was going on somewhere. And obviously, Biden, in his usual imbecilic, mendacious, senile fashion, you know, made a mistake. He pulled, I mean, instead of leaving troops there and then, you know, removing the troops after he removed all these refugees or people he was trying to get out, he at first, you know, he first removed the troops, and the enemy grabbed, $70 or $80 billion worth of high tech, weaponry, you know, and then we helped to hold Americans and our allies hostages. So you know, much of the crisis came about because Biden is an idiot handled the situation. He and his Secretary of State, Mr. Blinken, who also seems to be cognitively challenged, they handled the situation so badly that it became a kind of mini crisis. But there's no way you can compare this to the Vietnam War. I mean, the Vietnam War is like a major war. I mean, when I hear these comparisons, it's like saying, you know, the people who broke into the Capitol, you know, it's like 9/11. I mean, they're saying that you have to be, or Pearl Harbor, you have to be a total partisan maniac or a low grade moron to believe anything like that. All right. Mm-hmm. But I think that this is almost a similarly ridiculous exaggeration, which you hear on Fox all the time, by the way, but this is nothing like the war in Vietnam. It is nothing of the same magnitude.
And what is your opinion regarding Nixon's handling of the withdrawal and the public response to it?
You mean Nixon's withdrawal from Vietnam?
Yeah, and the public response to it.
It is interesting that the public was really sick of the war. Kissinger negotiated an agreement, you know, by which they were not going to invade South Vietnam immediately. I don't know how you can. And of course, as soon as the Americans were withdrawn, even before they were withdrawing them, you have a massive invasion of the North Vietnamese army into the South, you know, and they take it simply by conquering, by coming in and conquering. And you know, there were some Americans who got chased out. I suppose that's the point of resemblance, mm-hmm. or the overlap. The problem about getting reinvolved is that nobody wanted it. There was talk about not allowing, you know, the North Vietnamese to break the agreement to invade, and we should, you know, send back troops and at least until we could evacuate all of our people. But the Democrats, who were then controlling Congress, did not want it. And I think by then most Americans just didn't want to be involved anymore.
I agree entirely that there was just at the end, obviously I didn't live through it, but I have researched it a lot. At the end, there was just a lack of will to keep the conflict going. Mm-hmm. So I think that Nixon handled it, practically speaking, as well as he could have. There were big interests in keeping America in Vietnam, and they were not necessarily fond of Nixon, and I think that the public never really did give him the credit he deserved for bringing Vietnam to a conclusion. So that's my take there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Paul has a much more rich one because of his life experience, having been around back then. Now, as for the next question, do you believe our slow withdrawal was due to the unwillingness of North Vietnam to negotiate, the political maneuvering of Nixon, or both? Paul, anything to say about that?
Well, it was not really a slow withdrawal. I mean, they pulled troops out, and the North Vietnamese just staged an invasion. I think there was some face saving agreement that was made, that was negotiated by Kissinger with the North Vietnamese prior to this withdrawal. But it was not surprising that the North Vietnamese did what they did. you know, it's not surprising that the Taliban decided to invade, you know, after the Americans were the American troops were withdrawn. But it was not slow. It was a very quick withdrawal, in fact. And you know, that's what emboldened the other side to come and invade.
I think that what he meant was the fact that the war didn't just end like soon after Nixon got into office. That at least was my impression. But no, I do agree that the withdrawal itself, once it did start, was quite fast. Mm-hmm. And I think that it happened really because of Nixon's political maneuvering, many different maneuverings, I should say. Mm-hmm. And North Vietnam also was not going to negotiate, obviously, because it correctly perceived that it was on the winning side of the conflict. So I think both things did play into that, to what ultimately happened. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, there was also an underlying assumption at the time that the United States gets involved in the war in the early 1960s, that the Russians and the Chinese would both use Vietnam as a base of expansion throughout Indochina, which, by the way, happened because all these, you know, Indochinese republics or whatever you call it, Cambodia, Laos, all of which have been run by the French at one time, they all fall to communist regimes.
Yes.
And in the case of Cambodia, you have, you know, rival communist fighting, and one group is so vicious they murdered large numbers of people and seem to be committing genocide. But the area did fall to the communists. The thing that sort of messes up this narrative with this prediction is that the Chinese and Russians fall out between themselves. They become rivals. And finally, the Russians sort of lose interest in the whole deal, mm-hmm. right? And even the Chinese, I mean, it just goes on for a very long time. And curiously, after Vietnam falls, the area does not become any kind of beachhead for communist expansion. It becomes an economic backwater. They invite Americans and others to come in there, you know, invest money, come back and take it over. So, I mean, it turns out in a way that people could not have predicted in the early 1960s. There was some effort to get the United States involved when Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh managed to kick out the French, or the French leave after the siege of Dien Bien Phu in 1954. The war was generally unpopular, but then you had the French left, much of which was pro-communist, mm-hmm. Actually supported the communist side, or what they saw as the communist side, because there were non-communists also fighting in the Viet Minh. But there was some effort made by John Foster Dulles to get Eisenhower interested in sending troops or doing something there. And Ike refused. You know, he just didn't want anything to do with the place. That's why he is, among other reasons, why he is the favorite president of my lifetime. He knew when not to get involved.
And what are your impressions regarding the Vietnam Veterans Against the War organization? Was it just a leftist outfit who cared more about the North Vietnamese rather than our own troops? And in case I didn't make it clear enough, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, I believe it was meant to be read in air quotes. Anyway, Paul, before I share my thoughts, any take on that?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of groups that, you know, that support the Vietnam, the Veterans Against the War in Vietnam. They weren't all like the people you see in Born on the 4th of July, you know, that movie where this fellow with a Slavic name from some small town becomes
Ron Kovic, I think, from Long Island.
Right. In Long Island, he becomes a violent opponent, and everybody back home was a super supporter. I do not remember anything like that. Mm-hmm. The people who opposed the war were sort of a motley crew made up of everything from communist sympathizers, and there were many of those, by the way, mm-hmm. To just people who had been badly wounded, like Mr. Kovic, and you know, who were lost limbs and were paraplegic. There were some of those, but I suspect there was, you know, just mostly the same kind of people you saw at other anti-war demonstrations, you know, in the 1960s and early 1970s. People didn't want to get drafted. Others who were drafted and were just angry. You even occasionally found people who said, you know, the war was a good idea. We just didn't knock the hell out of them soon enough, and now we should get out. I mean, I remember hearing that as well. I think that who these people really were is something in between Kovich in the movie a communist front organization. You probably had both.
No, I agree with. I think there was a real legitimate hunger for an anti-Vietnam War movement among soldiers who had been there, who were drafted, who didn't want to go, and then you know that some of them came home with lost limbs. All of them, I would say, saw somebody who they befriended die or get seriously injured and have their life ruined. So I think there was a serious movement. There was a serious desire for a movement like the Soldiers Against the War. But at the same time, to think that organized leftist interests, particularly those with alliances to the Soviet Union, to think that they weren't involved with the whole thing is ridiculous. So I would agree with Paul that it was a combination, really, as to what the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, as to the groups that made up this organization. And the next question, do you believe that anti-war protests had any effect on what was really happening, on what really was happening behind the scenes in government, or is it just some boomer fantasy that they stood up to power and won? That's a very good question, Paul. Before I share my thoughts, any ideas about it?
I think the extent and the duration of the anti-war protests had a profound effect on ending the war. I mean, we're basically facing these anti-war protests every day, every place was going on everywhere. It was a very, very unpopular war. And I think it was it really helped bring the left to power in a way that has not changed. If you sort of think back in 1968, there was an election and Nixon won, by the skin of his nose, barely. He should have won but he was not a particularly good campaigner. But George Wallace, who was running on the right, was got 13-14% of the vote. In 1972, Nixon absolutely swamps McGovern, who had a past of being sort of very sympathetic to the communists. He even voted for Henry Wallace in 1948, who was sort of a communist front candidate. He beat him badly, but by 1976, the country had moved to the left. And I think the kind of organizational effort that the anti-war movement engaged in had permanent effects on American society, because much of what later on became leftist leadership came out of the anti-war movement. And not just the New Left, New Left activists, but, people got their start, Bill Clinton, others, who were part of the anti-war movement. Clinton became president. Hillary was part of the anti-war movement. So you get like a whole generation of people who become leftist leaders who've been part of the anti-war movement. Very, very often you get Democrats who are draft dodger. Clinton was a draft dodger, anti-war, all this other stuff. He wins against George H.W. Bush, who was a World War II hero, or had fought and had his plane down and landed up having to be rescued and so forth. And then you also have contests in which anti-war candidates on the left are running against conservative veterans on the right or something. Well, I mean the anti-war left generally does better. Because the cities, they sort of piggyback onto the anti-war movement, and they become involved. They combine this, by the way, with the civil rights movement. They sort of dovetail at a certain point. Martin Luther King had originally not taken a strong position against the war. He lands up attacking the war as a racist war directed against colored people. Mm-hmm. So that's like listening to Black Lives Matter today. The anti-war movement had legs, and It keeps going somewhere. It merges with other lefts, or other lefts become identified with the anti-war movement. So I think there's really no way that you could understand the present left in the United States without also factoring in the anti-war movement. Now, I know there are other things I've talked about, the civil rights movement and the civil rights legislation, the Voting Rights Act, the immigration reform, etc. But domestic, the force that domestically worked to keep the left together, to keep it excited, well mobilized, you know, and which finally merges with the civil rights activists is the anti-war movement.
I agree with what Paul said, by the way. I was trying to think if there's anything I could add to it, but I'm in agreement with his perspective there. Mm-hmm. And then this is the last question, at least from this fellow. Was Nixon ever given credit for cooling tensions with the Soviet Union and China, which was crucial in forcing the North Vietnamese to back down and release our prisoners? I'll just very quickly say, no, I don't think he was ever given adequate credit for that at all. And the media hated him much in the same way it hated Trump. And just as Nixon had a presidency that had many great achievements, Trump did. And the media, you know, overlooked all of it in favor of petty nonsense, in my opinion, even if it had to invent that nonsense, or perhaps especially when it had to do so. Arguably, the blueprint used to take down Trump by the media was the same one used against Nixon, just sort of 2.0, if you will. Paul, anything to say about the question or my take on it?
I entirely agree with you on this. I've begun to notice this recently, that people who hate Nixon also hate Trump.
Absolutely.
And even people who I know are fairly conservative, if they hate one, they hate the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, for some reason, I think Nixon was fine in foreign policy. He was a highly intelligent man. And, mm-hmm. you know, he was someone I knew personally. I met him many times, and I did look up to him. I don't think he did much good domestically. I think he was treated in an utterly despicable manner by the leftist media. I don't have quite the same high regard for Trump as a person, but obviously he was treated the same way, even more viciously. On the other hand, I don't remember Reagan being beaten up on in quite the same way. Mm-hmm. I mean, they'll tell you, you know, they hated Reagan. It was nothing like this. And I think part of it was that Reagan went out of his way to be nice to the left. Mm-hmm. He tried never to disturb, at least the media. He tried to get along with them. He would joke with them. He tried to be non-confrontational. Whereas both Trump and Nixon, I think perhaps almost unintentionally because of his personality, mm-hmm. You know, landed up fighting with the media, and which both treated very badly.
Yeah, I agree entirely. And also, this is not a question, but just commentary. With regard to the question that was asked of us, the questioner's answer is probably not, since Trump is the only person who the media hated more. It is funny or depressing to me how the endings of American-backed governments in South Vietnam and Afghanistan parallel each other, at least in this one aspect. After each government collapsed, America imports over 100,000 foreigners from halfway around the world. At least Vietnamese people are less inclined to gang rape women and boys just for the hell of it. I very much appreciate your streams and Dr. Gottfried's insights. I am very excited to read his book on anti-fascism. Paul, I think very appreciable commentary.
Yeah, it is. I totally agree with this gentleman. We lost nothing by bringing in the Vietnamese, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yep. They became physicians or accountants, engineers, whatever. Mm-hmm. We did very well. We're not going to do as well with the Afghans, mm-hmm. the Afghanis or Afghans. But there are hundreds of thousands who've been brought here, not necessarily the ones who helped our troops, because there is high hopes that they will vote for the Democratic Party.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a political ploy, period. Yeah. No two ways about that. Now, from Mark Erzhavec, Angela Merkel is retiring, thank God. This maniac allowed 1 million Syrians into Germany, and she is meant to be part of a right-wing party. What will happen to Germany if the left-wing party comes in? Very bad things. I think they'll even be worse than Merkel, bad as she was, Mark. Paul, anything to say about what Mark brought up?
Well, you know, I don't have the latest. There's a kind of just general, what I'm thinking the German word, eine Hochrechnung, like a kind of general survey of what's going on there. It looks like the left isn't going to do all that well. There was 11% that voted for the AfD and 11% that voted for the Freie Demokraten. The SPD and the Christian Democrats, which is called the Union, their union of the Christ Demokraten and the, the other one, the Christ Sozialen, they seem to have about the same number of votes. As my friend told me earlier, das war die Biden Partei und das war die Linken Gleichauf. The two parties are neck and neck. So, you know, it's going to be a call. They're not going to include the AfD. I don't know if they'll include the Freie Demokraten, because the Union generally is a leftist party now. There's no way Merkel is any kind of conservative. She is, you know, she simply patches together an alliance of the left. And then the fact that she has a Christian Democratic Association after being a longtime communist, you know, and changing her party affiliations at the right, or affiliations, you know, what looked like the Berlin Wall was going to come down and so forth. You know, by virtue of that, she's also the fact that the American media likes her and calls her a conservative. That makes her a conservative. She may last. She may not be retiring. They may just keep her because she is the Germans love Merkel, not because she does anything good for the country, but she is well liked by the liberal media outside of Germany. You know, as my friend said, sie ist bei den ausländischen Medien das war ganz beliebt. She's well liked by the foreign media. And the Germans do not want to be called Nazis or fascist or right-wing or want the liberal media to love them throughout the solar system, everywhere. So this is why, you know, Merkel is great, because CBS, NBC, BBC, they all love her. You know, the chance will just stay on. She's not that old. And the people who are being suggested in her place really have no standing. There is somebody from Die Grünen named Baerbock, who's very pretty and very stupid and very far leftist on every cultural social issue. And she's anti-German, which means the Germans will probably like her. She has no stature. I think she's 40 years old. And she's not even a lesbian. You think that, you know, she had decency at least to be a lesbian in Germany to get into politics, or homosexual. She's, you know, I think she's even married to some girly man. I could actually see Merkel just staying on. There's absolutely nobody there who is you know, in a position to take over. And, you know, whoever is there will be in a very sort of precarious to sort of patch together an alliance. You know, it looks like you have Die Grünen, I don't know, they got 12-13% or something, the SPD. But the SPD might as well be allied to the Christian Democrats. They're pretty much the same. I can't think of any difference, except the Christian Democrats get more Catholic votes and the other ones get more Protestant votes, though Merkel's a Protestant, the daughter of a Protestant minister. But that's just the way it breaks down. But neither party is in any sense Christian or traditional. You know, it's just a matter of voting habit.
And from Klutgen, I know I probably mispronounced the name, but from Klutgen, opinions on Hegel's philosophy of right. Who would you recommend as far as German romantic or idealist philosophers of the right? Any works in particular stand out? This is clearly not a question for me. I have nothing to say, but for Paul, I think there could be some great answers.
I don't know whom to recommend. I love them all. <don't know. laughs> They're all great. I love German idealist philosophy. I mean, from Kant on, I've studied this many years, and I've written on Hegel and Schopenhauer. I adore Nietzsche. I mean, they're all fine. You know, I Heidegger is a fascinating figure, but he's almost impenetrable in English or in German or in any of the language in which I've tried to read him. But you know, it's a fascinating subject, and you know, I don't even know where to tell you to start in your attempt to master this discipline.
And any opinions on Hegel's philosophy of right?
On Hegel?
Yes. And on any opinions on Hegel's philosophy of
right? Yeah, I know, the Rechtsphilosophie, the philosophy of right. It's a great work. You know, I mean, it's the man had immense learning. And, you know, if you look at it, he really is showing you the progression of political consciousness in history. And the first part of it deals actually with individual right, or the development of individual right, which corresponds epistemologically to the individual becoming conscious of himself, right? You know, it culminates in the state, but the state understanding is having an ethical essence, and bringing the otherwise conflicting members of civil society together. You know, at the end, it's almost a kind of idealized Prussian monarchy, but one that is has a constitutional system of some kind that he's presenting. And, you know, he says the fullest consciousness of political freedom exists in Germanic Protestant societies, which I think by the time he was writing was true. You know, I won't even question that. Today we may have different ideas.
To say the least. From Douglas Edward, 84. In Canada's election, it appears that the PPC and other right wing have cost the CPC up to 26 seats. I expected the party would dump O'Toole as his moderation strategy failed so badly, yet they are doubling down. Why do elite conservatives always do this? This is a great question, because this is exactly what the Republicans wanted to do after Romney lost. They did their autopsy, and they wanted to double down on essentially Romneyism. And thankfully, it did not work out, only because of Trump. But no, there's no question that the Conservative Party of Canada, which is the CPC, obviously, they have not learned their lesson. And so that means that Bernier's People's Party of Canada will still be around as an influence from the right on the conservatives. And because of that, the conservatives are going to have a much more difficult time at the next general election of attaining power. And it's highly doubtful that the next general election is all too long away, because Trudeau did not get the majority he wanted. So very interesting. But why do they always do this? I think because a lot of them live in a bubble where they believe that what is popular among their peers is somehow reflective of society at large. And also, I think they just want the respectability of their peers, to live in a certain socioeconomic realm where they would not be looked at as, you know, unmentionables or untouchables, to use the language of the Indian caste system. So I think that is a lot of it, Douglas Edward. I think it's ignorance and fear melding into one. Paul, anything to say about what Douglas Edward brought up?
Well, you know, the Canadian situation is the same as the German situation, mm-hmm. the Belgian situation, the French situation. Mm-hmm. You just go across some of these, you know, European countries, and you find they all have right-wing populist parties that are unmentionable. Mm-hmm. Even if they get 40% of the vote, they're kept out of government. No one will have anything to do with them. Mm-hmm. And there's a good reason. Because if you let them into an alliance system, the media calls you a Nazi, and your own political career becomes endangered. I think the major reason, you know, and I suggest this in my book on anti-fascism, I have a chapter on these right-wing populist parties and why they can never take power. A part of it is the media. You know, I mean, the AfD is not a far-right party by anybody except for psychos or something. There's nothing in the party. I mean, they simply are what the Christian Democrats were before Merkel took over, plus a few people who, you know, believe in, I don't know, free market capitalism, but they seem to be moving away from that. And they want to sort of limit immigration in the country. Well, they don't want to send anybody back. But yet they're considered an unmentionable neo-Nazi party. The same thing for the Rassemblement National in France, for the what is it, the Flams Belang or whatever it is in Belgium, the Flemish, they're separatists because they've pretty much given up. The only place where these sort of right-wing populist or nationalist parties can do well is Italy. I mean, they're parts of coalitions there.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look, I mean, there was even had a neo-fascist mayor, but things haven't changed very much.
Mm-hmm.
But the media has to sort of organize people against, you know, a right-wing fascist takeover. Mm-hmm. And they just don't have too many of these people left anymore. So what they do is they turn their wrath against parties that are slightly out of step with what the media want parties to be. So, and they will go after you because they have to create some, it's a bugaboo, but they have to create some kind of enemy on the right. Mm-hmm. So they go after the AfD, the Flams Belang, and so forth. So the problem is the Canadian populist right just don't, or the progressive conservatives don't want these people there because they're going to be constantly attacked. I remember even when they tried to give a position to Preston Manning, you know, like 20 years ago or 25 years ago, even though his father, I think, had been a premier in, I don't know, where, Alberta or someplace.
Yeah, I believe it was Alberta, yeah.
Right. I think he was a social creditist, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But Preston Manning was, you know, was treated as an outsider, some sort of dangerous neo-fascist and so forth. So these people don't want to risk the danger. The other thing is many of them are raised in a leftist woke educational system. And they live in a woke culture, even if they're running, you know, as candidates of a party called, in fact, they're called Progressive Conservatives. Gives the game away. Why not reactionary conservative?
I take it that you don't take the progressive conservatives seriously as conservatives at
no,
all.
No. I think the Dutch had a party like the Anti-Revolutionary Calvinist Party or something. I take them seriously. They're called anti-revolutionary, so they're the real thing.
It's crazy stuff, to say the least. By the way, folks, this is not the last call, but it is the second to last call. If you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please do leave it via Streamlabs. This is not the last call, but the second to last call. Thank you very much in advance. From K-Max McDonald, for Paul, I just watched a PBS special on Muhammad Ali. What was your view of Ali's political impact on civil rights? Was Ali in the Martin Luther King camp or more in the Nation of Islam camp?
I don't necessarily buy the distinction between the two. I know that's very popular, you know, among neoconservatives and Fox News. But I mean, King said, you know, if you don't listen to me, riots are going to break out in cities tomorrow, which sounds like the other side. No, he was a big activist. He was a convert to the black Muslims. I suppose, I don't know, he probably believed that, you know, whites had the souls of devils or so, something like that. I am utterly disgusted by the attempt to turn him into some kind of hero, even in his lifetime. And, you know, when he fought other blacks who were not as radical, you know, he attacked them as Uncle Toms, and all the lefties at the time would go there and cheer him on because he represented, you know, a pure black nationalism or something like that. I never found him a very congenial figure, and I can't say I ever rooted for him as a boxer.
And from Jonathan, why do Deep Blue, Massachusetts, Vermont, and occasionally Maryland still elect Republican governors while California shuns electing a Republican? Well, there are two answers to this very good question. And the first, I mean, obviously pertains to demographics. If California is as white as the other states you mentioned, or well, as Massachusetts and Vermont are, I'll talk about Maryland in a minute, Republicans there would be competitive. Not saying they would necessarily win, but they'd be competitive. Then the second thing, which sets California apart from these other places, is that the Republican Party in Massachusetts, Vermont, and Maryland does have more of a there is more of a distinction between its maneuverings and the maneuverings of the National Republican Party. So the state Republican parties are able to run on issues without being seen by the electorate there, as somehow, you know, tied into whatever's going on at the national level. And in Maryland, it's actually very similar to Massachusetts, not necessarily Vermont in this way, but it's thought of as a check on Democratic corruption. So that's why this stuff happens. Very good question, Jonathan. Paul, anything to say about it?
Yeah, I don't think they are all that different. I think if California were to run a Charlie Baker type Republican, or the Republican governor of Maryland, who sounds usually like a liberal Democrat whenever I hear him interviewed, they could possibly win. I remember they ran some very liberal woman for governor a few years ago in California, and she did pretty well. She almost won. If you run somebody like Larry Elder, whom I actually like a great deal, I'd be delighted to vote for him. But he's not going to win, because he's a conservative Republican. So basically, you know, if you want to win in a blue state like Maryland or California, you're going to have to run with a Republican who would be mistaken for Bernie Sanders or Chuck Schumer or somebody. I mean, you have to run with a very liberal candidate. That said, I do think Joseph has a point. I mean, these sort of blue eastern states are almost sort of, you know, they're basically white states, in some cases, which used to be conservative or Republican. But, you know, they still have a kind of white middle class electorate. Maryland doesn't, but obviously Vermont does, Massachusetts does. You know, so these people would not be as averse to voting Republican as certainly the non-white population of California. But in California, the white population is pretty far to the left, too. Mm-hmm. I think a majority of whites did vote to retain Newsom.
Yes, they did. Yeah. It says it all, really. From Kay Warren, a very generous contribution to the show. Thank you, Kay. Culture war is zero-sum game. Bureaucracy versus patriarchy. Right now, right is only now starting to fight back on leftist lock on federal government. Recent Texas and Missouri legislation, for example, isn't in pursuit of good governance, but rather is leading up to state nullification. Very interesting perspective, Kay. I would not be surprised to see, as the left attains more and more power, particularly in the executive branch of the federal level, I would not be surprised to see states doing more aggressive stuff to try to, say, nullify federal mandates and such. That wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. Paul, anything to say about what Kay brought up?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, go back to the doctrine of nullification, although James Madison supported it. So did John C. Calhoun and, you know, some of these Southern Democrats before antebellum Southern Democrats. They're not going to get away with that, because the federal government just has too much power to allow that to happen. But, you know, Democrats have played the same sort of game when they've had state or local power. We're gonna have sanctuary cities. We're gonna let all these illegals come in. We like, you know, marijuana, the best federal law against it. We'll use it anyhow. So, I mean, both sides will fall back on states' rights depending on whether it's advantageous. I don't think either side, you know, believes deeply in states' rights, you know, as a high political principle. But I think both sides would be willing to use it, you know, as far as they can get away with it in order to be able to resist the other side.
And from K. Max McDonald, Paul, Cotto informed me, sadly, that the H.L. Mencken Club or conference is no more due to wokeness. Can you both elaborate to me what happened? I thought about attending it if it were held in Baltimore this year. Well, I think that, you know, the long and the short of it, K-Max, basically is what I said. Wokeness became such an issue that the Mencken Club, just putting on its, you know, very respectable, dare I say, lavish annual conference, it simply became prohibitive. It's an unfortunate consequence of these rather degenerate times in which we live. But since Paul was the head of the club, anything to say about what K-Max brought
up? Yeah, I think that, some groups on the right, or conservative groups, can get away with what they do in criticizing the left. We could for a number of years. Then we sort of came, in or fell into the crosshairs of, of leftist groups. And we finally found members of our organization being blacklisted by conservative groups because we're getting hit so relentlessly by the left. At which point, it seemed to be futile trying to hold these conferences, even if we had 100 or 120 people coming and so forth. The problem would be to attract speakers, particularly after what happened in one case, and I don't want to go into this because I think it's it's extremely delicate matter. This person was almost ruined professionally because he spoke at a Mencken Club meeting on a subject that had nothing to do with race. It was in fact on educational standards. But by then we were so much in the in the critical limelight of the left that we were just moving targets. At which point I decided to call it a day, and I think the board, I think we agreed that it would be foolhardy to try to maintain the organization any longer.
Yes, very unfortunately, but yes, that is what happened. And now this is the last call. If you have a reasonable, responsible question or comment for Paul or myself, please leave it via Streamlabs. Thank you very much in advance. The link is now out in the chat. Let me see if anything else came up for us on Streamlabs. But no, it's interesting, Paul, the state of affairs now. Quite clearly, it is anarcho-tyranny, which obviously we've discussed in the past, where certain groups can get away with, not only doing whatever they want in terms of their own lives, but, tyrannizing others. But at the same time, others have the boot heel brought down on them. at a moment's notice, it's quite interesting, but this is very third world like, in my opinion. And see the U.S. sliding into this is symptomatic of its overall more third world like situation.
Yeah, I'm having this debate with somebody in Chronicles about whether critical race theory should be taught in universities, and I think they have about the same right of being taught as Nazi. Anti-Semitism or some other form, some other hate doctrines or something like that. And I made a comparison, and this friend said, how can you compare American universities to Nazi universities? Well, I can't. The American universities are worse. Hitler had no great interest in universities. Once he took power, he turned them into military camps. What distinguishes the left from other forms of totalitarianism is that the left really wants to use every means at its disposal, the media, education, whatever it has, to destroy its enemies, to brainwash everybody. It'll go on and on. And you look at even universities under the Third Reich, in which I've written, and you have people like Karl Jaspers, Hans-Georg Gadamer, other people who were not Nazis in any sense, who were allowed to teach. They were not harassed. Even under the Nazis, I cannot imagine people who did not agree with wokeness and leftist views of being allowed to teach history or political theory at Yale University, my alma mater. I think the left is much more thorough than the Nazis in terms of trying to suppress intellectual dissent. The Nazis, of course, use terror and brutality and kill a lot of people. They're sort of like, Genghis Khan or Attila the Hun, but they do not have the same single-minded purpose, of controlling all sources of knowledge, everything you're allowed to say or think, and removing anyone who sort of holds a different point of view, even on an academic subject. The left does this in the United States and throughout the Western world today. Under the influence of the United States. These are our imitators. These are our dependents, right? There are lackeys who think they're like the Canadians. Oh, we have this social, we're independent. No, they're not. They're just imitators. They're almost clownish imitators of the Americans. They do whatever we do, and they want to show you they do more. It's more extreme there. I think the intellectual intolerance that we're seeing is absolutely appalling, and it's going to get worse. unless there are people on the right who are willing and able to push back.
And from K-Max, sorry, no, that was the wrong one. From Life of Brian, I think liberals are going through the phase that the left went through in the 60s, where they will stop even giving lip service to traditional liberal values, free speech and due process, and reconstitute under an open, technocratic, authoritarian ethos. I think that is quite correct, Brian. I don't know if there's much that I can add to it, but I think that's quite correct what you said. Paul, anything to say about what Brian brought up?
Yeah, I don't think it's correct at all. I think it's much, much worse than anything I saw in the 1960s. And I was around in the 1960s. I was in college. I graduate school. I got a PhD. You had people on the left. It was nothing compared to what we're seeing now. I mean, in terms of its thoroughness, in terms of the insanity of the left, there's nothing. I said you have to go back to Nazi Germany to find anything like this. And it's getting worse, and it's worse in other places than it is in the United States, among our imitators, the clowns who imitate us, like Justin Trudeau and these other people. It's worse. But, you know, in the 60s, you could still have open debates. You could debate all kinds of things in the 60s. You could talk about different IQ levels among different races. You know, they weren't going to shoot you or hang you for saying this, or the conservative movement wouldn't denounce you for saying it, certainly. No, I think the 60s were a relatively tolerant period of time, even on the left, compared to what we're seeing right now.
And speaking of the left, before we get to what I believe is the last question, Paul and I often talk about a rather interesting new development in politics. Pete Buttigieg, or Buttigieg, or whatever it's pronounced, and his, I called him husband, but Paul takes offense to my calling him husband. I'll just say gentleman friend, Chasten. They adopted two kids, and they did a mock thing in a mock maternity ward, a photo op, where they're holding the babies as if one of them just gave birth. And to Paul, this represents the absolute nadir of leftism. Am I right, Paul? This represents sort of...
Yeah, right. No. I mean, going back to the 1960s, I could not have imagined, you know, this sort of righteous display of human perversity that we see here. I mean, I couldn't even think of it, even among the radical leftists I knew. No, I think we've reached a level of moral degeneracy as well as intolerance that would have been inconceivable to me even at the height of the 1960s.
And also, I think it's safe to say that you're not on the team of Pete and his significant other in this matter.
No, not at all.
You're not a member of their fan club. Mm-hmm. All right. From K-Max. As people of the right, should we be happy when the left cannibalizes their own? Shelley Ross, a left-wing media person, is accusing Chris Cuomo of groping her. If Cuomo gets canned, should we cheer? I feel we should cheer it. I think that it represents something bad, a sort of a scarlet letter type situation for men, and that's very destructive. But at the same time, it's good to see the lefties who promoted this scarlet letter type behavior get a taste of their own medicine. So I have mixed feelings about it, K-Max. That's the honest perspective from my end. I wouldn't criticize someone for feeling one way or the other about it. Paul, anything to say about what K-Max brought up?
I love seeing the left destroy itself. I want to see them do this every second. I want to see more and more of them fighting with each other because the right is not going to win. The right has been emasculated by the conservative movement, by the progressive conservatives in Canada, by the Christian Democrats. We need a dynamic. We don't have the dynamic force to win. The only thing that will allow us to survive is that the left destroys itself. Mm-hmm. And I'm delighted. I'm delighted what's happening in New York. I hope Black Lives Matter, you know, run in and occupy City Hall there. I'm on their side, by the way. I'm supporting Black Lives Matter. You know, I support the Muslims against the feminists, or the feminists against the Muslims, depending on which side can destroy the other.
And the last one from K-Max. In speaking with an Indian friend of mine, he told me non-Westerners were far more racist than Western peoples. In China or India, the view of blacks is much worse. Mm-hmm. Tell this to an SJW woke leftist in America. I think your perspective is spot on, K-Max. And I'm trying to think if there's anything I could add to it, but no, I think it's spot on. Very glad you brought it up. Paul, anything to say about what K-Max?
Yeah, he's absolutely right. White Americans are the most tolerant, racially tolerant people on the face of the planet. You know, you say, well, they used to be racist, but even in the past, less so than anybody else. You know, so you know, it's we have to speak in relative terms here. But I don't think the left expects any great things from most of the Asians. You know, they're not counting on the Chinese or the Koreans to rally to them. You know, when the Black Lives Matter were burning down Korean groceries, and they didn't give a damn about the Koreans. I also didn't give a damn about the blacks who were black cops who were being shot. but I don't think they have the, there's certain groups of Asians that will always support the left. Like you can get, 99% of people from India or some very high percentage, even though they live in very traditional hierarchical homes and don't want to marry outside their own group. They feel like they're strangers living in a racist country or whatever. So they'll support the left. So the left doesn't have to worry about them, although they can occasionally trot them out, but they will say, we are not white people. The same attempt, of course, is made to appeal to Asians that, we're not white. But I don't think they really buy that. People from the Far East don't really buy that at all. Maybe some of the Filipinos do, who are still in the Democratic camp in California and elsewhere. But I think that dislike is true. I think the friendship between Hispanics and blacks is going to come apart. It's going to come unglued very, very fast.
Yeah, I think that absolutely is in the process of happening. As a matter of fact, we saw some precursors to this out in California as early as a few years ago, where blacks and Hispanics started to have big tensions out there, especially gang-related tensions. And I suppose what the conflict that was there has just come into the political realm and now it's spreading across the country. Although, thankfully, it's not a nationwide gang war. Although, considering where America is heading, who the hell knows what will happen next? But anyway, no, I do believe that was the last one. I'm going to do a refresh just to make sure. But, Paul, this has been, I think, an especially rewarding discussion. So much good stuff was brought up, and I really enjoyed myself. I hope you did, too.
But you say that every time. This is an especially good session, right?
Yes. But yeah, all of them are very good, so I really don't have any complaints. But I did enjoy this one very much so.
But we're not as good as Don Lemon and those other people on CNN. Who are fountains or of wisdom, they just keeps coming out of them every time they open their mouths.
We're not there yet, but perhaps one day we shall be able to approach their level of greatness.
Right.
There is one thing here, by the way, from Life of Brian. Good thing I did the last refresh. He says, the left, sadly, will not eat itself. The real left is a clique of connected oligarchs who can literally get away with murder. The lumpen left rabble will continue as terrorized zombies with Stockholm syndrome forever. Cuomo will land smoothly. Very interesting take, Brian. Gives me a lot to think over, as a matter of fact. I'm not sure there's much I could say on it right now, but it's very interesting and very thought-provoking. Paul, anything to say about what Brian brought
up? I think he's right. I think behind the left that we see, which is made up of the screwballs and the race haters and so forth, the crazy women, Chastin, Buttigieg, and so forth, you do have corporate giants. You have the high tech oligarchs who are and the deep state and the surveillance agencies, which are now allied to the left. But I think those alliances can come apart, particularly if the left, once the left starts crumbling, or at least one might say the outer circles become weaker. Once the blacks start fighting with the feminists or the Muslims, with somebody, at whatever point the left becomes more fragile or more brittle, It will become less useful to these powerful interests that are now payrolling the left. They may just sort of lose their interest. I also think that at some point there will be legislation that will be imposed on high tech. I think if the Republicans win the next year's elections, as you know, as timid as they seem, they are going to do something to weaken the power of high tech, to make them more subject to government control. And you know, I think that's coming. I don't think there's any way it could be avoided. And even the, you know, the left wing of the Democratic Party want to weaken them. Mm-hmm. So I don't see their powers being permanent. I think with the corporations, they see the left as very powerful. That's one reason they support them. They want to be on the side of the winners. Mm-hmm. And if the left starts losing, they're not going to get the same kind of support.
No, I do agree with that. Though, of course, now there are people in corporate America and across the world who are motivated ideologically,
right,
as being on the left. But there's no doubt that the business realm does like winning. It likes making money, and it will not. It won't waste a lot of time with losers. I'll put it that
exactly.
way. So it'll be interesting to see what happens as time goes on. But that was the last one, Paul. Like I said, I had a good time tonight. I hope you did too.
So did I, yes.
Excellent. And everyone, thank you very much for tuning in. I hope that you enjoyed the show as well. See you next time. Before we go, though, if you like this episode and want to support the program, please consider donating to it by clicking on the PayPal link in the description below. Paul and I appreciate your generosity very much. Also, be sure to check out my new book, Runaway Masters. It's on Amazon. You can find it by following the link below. It's in the description. And that's pretty much it, everyone. Take it easy. I hope you have a great week, and cheers.